a couple of other things with neonates that you don't get with others. One of them is the fact that often they're perceived as not quite being people yet.
Oh, dear.
And they can be replaced in 9 months or so.
Oh, dear.
In your model.
Yeah.
So there's this, you know, that they're dispensable. But that's often the thought. And that's something that Peter Singer from Princeton has often said. The other thing
Well, Barb, before you move on, I wonder if you'd be willing to share what you had told me about what this neonatal administrator told you about.
Right.
That would be quite revealing.
Right. A director of a NICU in a Canadian hospital even told me that if he has two babies with the same, level of difficulty, and one of them has a younger set of parents who can always have another one, the other set of parents are older, and they've had maybe in vitro fertilization 3 times.
Right.
He said, well, I'm going to try harder for the baby with the older family, the older parents.
Right.
And you know, that is just, you have to scratch your head about that for a little bit.
Yeah.
That is just sort of classic public health care thinking.
Yeah.
The Americans would never go for that, because what's happening in the United States with your baby when you've paid your insurance is absolutely independent about what's going on with the next person's baby.
That's true.
And their business.
That's true.
There's no correlation.
Yeah.
Who are they treating, the child or the parents?
Yeah.
Well, the other thing I think that we have to be mindful of with issues in the NICU, possibly as the government might perceive them, is that a child who is allowed to survive and will have lifetime disability and perhaps complex medical care has a huge price ticket on their head.
Right.
And you know, we can't deny that this might be an impetus that we're not going to try so hard on that child because of the future costs. The government, in a public health care system, the government who perhaps reduces the number of NICU beds that forces certain decisions to be made and choices to be made, inadvertently perhaps, or maybe worse, is not only saving the future medical costs of that complex child, but the educational, social costs as well.
Right.
So, I mean, it's dark and it's sinister, but it's a windfall of savings.
Yeah,
think about it.
My answer to that is, although it wasn't a disability at childbirth. Look at someone like Stephen Hawking. You know, I've heard it said that we could be getting rid of the next Beethoven or the next and we don't know because we don't have the money.
Yeah,
I just sort of have this terrifying image that NICU, especially tertiary center NICUs, are almost have a designed or assumed or quietly understood role of nipping in the bud that very, very expensive citizen that is going to be draining provincial resources at a rate far beyond average, and in their view might contribute less than the average citizen, and so it's like a there's decreasing returns there that have to be accounted for, and all of a sudden miscreant practices can be permitted because there's a financial and society cost supposed justification for it. This is just an impression, but it's one that's not based in just fantasy. I've
lived
through different phases of this now.
I
don't know that there's any one person who sits down and dreams up such a strategy that can save the province millions upon tens of millions or more dollars just by making a few strategic decisions at the neonatal level.
Right.
It's a terrifying thought that has that warrants investigation and analysis.
Right, because, you look at Ontario here, quite mysteriously, we haven't published infant mortality rates for 5 years.
Oh.
What's that all about?
Yeah.
So Canada has been publishing a national rate that is void of 40% of the population.
Oh, really?
Barb, correct me if I'm wrong, but would it not be true that the statistics are still being compiled, they're just not being published?
Well, we can assume that, Sam. We're not sure, but it's hard to believe otherwise.
Why would they stop collecting the data?
Well,
it doesn't make sense.
The explanation given is that there's a sort of a data mismatch in that the parents must submit the birth certificate so that the death certificate can be matched in order to determine that there was an infant mortality rate.
But how is that different 5 years before?
Well, that's a good question. That's a good question. And why has it taken us 5 years to figure this out when all of the other provinces across Canada have got no problem at all? Yeah, that's
Or what else is it that happened 5 years ago that might be, making them not want to publish?
Well,
I can think of something that happened about five years ago.
That's funny you should ask, because what happened 5 years ago, roughly, was the initiation of, certainly in Ontario anyway, the government's fetal alert network, which is a sort of a genetic birth defect center, so that if any woman screens positive or if there's something found on an ultrasound, then...
May I apply another term to it that I've heard?
Uh-huh.
Search and destroy mission.
Yeah. Some people, Margaret Somerville, I believe, coined that phrase, search and destroy. So it's coincident, it seems, with the initiation of the fetal alert network that we ceased to publish our infant mortality rates. So the other thing, too, is, when we think about how decisions are made, one time I had a meeting with a health policy professor at the university, and I said to her, it seems to me that hospital policies, which are written to reflect a patient's rights and the laws, are sitting on a shelf gathering dust, and nobody follows them. They're not implemented. There's no accountability. And all decisions are made, and hospitals are run based on performance indicators and objectives, all tied to funding. Now, to me, that was a pretty insulting statement to say to a health policy professor. That's how I would have taken it. So I was shocked by her response. She said, well, I hope so. So, it seems that there's a general disregard for the laws that relate to the care of patients. And there's a good reason for that. The kind of patients that we're referring to, in this case, we're talking about vulnerable neonates with conditions probably related to disability, well, they have almost no value in the court of law. So really, all of these laws...
You should elaborate on that last statement, this access to justice issue.
That's right. So, to take a case... in which it seems that there was medical malpractice causing death involved, the value of a child with disabilities, say like Katya or like my daughter, might be worth $25,000 to $50,000 because that person was never going to earn an income. Yet the cost of litigation, on the other hand, and remember you're up against a large hospital with a lot of resources, is certainly in the order of $500,000. So it just would be not in anybody's sane mind to pursue that unless they had money in the order of $1 million hanging around.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we look at the court of law.
And what that translates into is not only is accessible justice denied a family that's encountered this kind of discrimination and wrongful death, not only is that the case, but you also have almost complete lack of a deterrent within the system, because they know that in the worst case, should they be discovered, the cost to them is absolutely minimal. As long as you can weasel out of any criminal implications, it's the cost savings for effecting this strategy of nipping the life in the bud, nipping the expensive life in the bud, the cost savings the province are so enormous compared to the very minimal risk. So it's from a financial standpoint, it's a great, it's a tiny risk to reward ratio that eliminates the natural deterrent that should be in the system.
Well, you've indicated.
And when we look at the basis for rationing or priority setting, as they call it, sounds a little nicer. One of the inputs to that is the values of the majority of the public. And this I heard from a doctor who develops priorities and rationing in Ontario. And now when you look at the values of the majority of the public for neonates with disabilities, well, I think that the values of the public are well known by the decision to terminate most of the pregnancies that relate to fetuses that might have these conditions. So their lives are possibly not deemed to be of little value to the majority, but because they would have terminated.
Just to qualify that statement, you said they're not well known, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're well based. And what I mean is this, that parents who would make a decision to go along with either withdrawal of life support in a neonatal, you know, or postnatal situation, or, you know, pre-birth in an abortion decision kind of situation, they may not be adequately truly informed about what they're really getting. I know what we were told, and this was after Katya was born. After Katya was born, we were told it's incompatible with life, it is a lethal condition. We were further led to believe things like, or they tried to make us believe things like, she might never smile, might not recognize her family, won't interact socially, and all of these things are so far, far from the truth as it manifested in Katya's life. So I think part of the problem isn't so much that necessarily that the decisions are being made as much as the decisions are being made without being duly informed or because of being misinformed. I think a lot of parents who were in my family's shoes, had they known that these kids grow up, if they survive infancy, they grow up to be quite, you know, quite possibly very happy children that have special contributions to them. So a lot of these people might not have decided to, you know, pull the plug on life support or pull the prostaglandin while awaiting surgery or any of these other interventions, might not have even decided to abort had they known the truth of the full range of outcomes that were possible for a child with that particular kind of chromosome.
Right.
We're supposed to be practicing medicine, and the movements in medicine, you know, ostensibly are to improve its family-centered care componentry and aspects. And I know there are a lot of initiatives being made. It's become a buzzword and a hot topic in healthcare in North America. And to be sure, there are family-centered care programs that are being advised on and well implemented and are on their way to doing good things. But there are others that are merely token and fake and too expensive in a number of ways to, for hospitals to take maybe as seriously as they could. I feel strongly for an aspect of the other side, and that we simply can't afford right now as a society to do everything we would like to for everyone.
Right.
And I hope I don't offend people here. I actually understand that rationing might have to take place, but what I do not accept is that the rationing would be done on an unethical or inequitable basis. It has to be fair. I wouldn't be surprised if, in retrospect, 50 years from now, people could look back at our era and find out that, my goodness, maybe we had a eugenics in numbers of victims that maybe rivaled what we've seen in terrible regimes of the past. When you think about all the babies who are voiceless and defenseless being eugenicized, if there's such a term, because of disability and their cost to society, or perceived cost to society and perceived inability to contribute equally.
Well, this is what Barb and I were talking about off the air for a minute. In your position again, Barb, was?
We were talking about that resources are not recognized in the law in a precedent case.
Yeah.
Related to withholding care. Sam
is making the case that there is no disincentive to this kind of discrimination, and in fact, some kind of counterweight, some kind of countermeasure needs to be put in place so that this doesn't happen. But you're making the case that we don't even, implicitly or explicitly, that we don't even use the laws that we have, that the court has not addressed some of these issues that are key.
I mean, in theory, these.
I would actually agree with that as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in theory, these things should never happen. We have laws related to consent. We have criminal laws related to active and passive euthanasia.
Mm-hmm.
The withdrawal of care without consent or where it might be beneficial to a patient. So in theory, we have a great system and we have great hospital policies that correlate to those laws.
Mm-hmm.
That's been my experience anyway. However, none of these things are implemented. Nobody's held accountable and the law is just not accessible.
Okay.
Like that.
Okay. All right.
I do believe that there are plenty enough laws within extant legislation to address and prevent these kinds of occurrences and unfair manifestations of inequitable rationing. I have no doubt that the legal language is already in place, especially if you include criminal law. But it's not only the access to justice is not only in the post-mortem sense. It is also in the live day-to-day event of keeping your baby safe in the healthcare system. Because I have been in situations with Katya where her life was in danger.
Right.
It was, clinically clearly the case, and there were easily defined medical reasons for it, and I could not access help from the system that was immediate enough and open enough to making a quick enough case of it for her benefit.
Right.
I will share this, and that I will tell you that members of the family that is related to Isaiah James Fay, an extended family, there is a real sense, and it must be crushing to them, that the hospital has given up hope, and that this was the case from the very beginning.
Okay.
How does a family go into a situation like this about their own child and have to cope with not only the reality of what their child is facing, their family is facing, the potential loss and challenge, but that the hospital where they've gone to help, get help for the child, the hospital has given up hope from the very beginning?
Yeah. Okay.
Where is the medicine in that?
Yeah. Final comments from you, Bart, and from you, Sam?
Well, I guess we're all really hoping for a miracle for little baby Isaiah. And I think that goes for the healthcare team as well. I mean, everybody would love for him to open his eyes, start breathing spontaneously long before any court decisions have to be made. And so let's keep that hopeful thought.
All right. And Sam?
Hopefully he won't even need a miracle. I would certainly welcome that. But there is progress. If there's clinical advancement in his status, whether it's for reasons of miracles or simply what was going to happen with Isaiah anyway, or through careful administration of interventions, that's great. I think we need a miracle in our healthcare system,
okay,
and in our justice system, so that we can become the ethical society that some of us pretend exists, but ought to. Really, really ought to exist. I think we're capable of it.
Okay. I thank you both for spending so much time on this subject on the show. Hopefully it sparks some thought in all the players involved in this conflict.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.